Episode 9 of Top Turtle MMA is brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards. Sisu Mouthguards, the thinnest, lightest, strongest mouthguard on the market. Gumby, do you have a Sisu mouthguard?
Obviously, I have a Sisu mouthguard. I care about my teeth. So we head into Open Mat right after the show every single Monday when we're taping, and both of us got our Sisu mouthguards. We pop them in and make sure that we're protected, and we can talk our way through most of the drills we're doing.
I have a Max Guard, as do you, because that's for high-impact sports. But if you're more of a team sport kind of gal or guy, you could get the Aero Guard. And hey, if you're a little tyke, get the Junior Guard. It's for youth sports.
And if you're a little tyke, watch the language while we're listening to this show.
I try not to curse, but it's a problem. Anyway, Sisu Mouthguards brings you Episode 9 of Top Turtle MMA, and because our entire podcast studio blew up today, we have no music and nothing fancy for you. We're just going to get right into our show.
All right. crazy little explosion. Right before I got here, actually, Dave was telling me sparks flying. Our number one computer was not working. Luckily, he ran a whole bunch of kind of crazy MacGyver-looking stuff
together. I was not going to allow us to not talk about what happened on Saturday. And before we do, I'll just say that if you are a regular listener, we thank you for the download. We are, of course, available on TuneIn, Stitcher, iTunes, and, of course, MMA-Manifesto.com is our parent website. You could catch us there as well. And if you want to email us, it's topturtlemma@gmail.com.
And if you want to follow us, follow me at Gumby Vreeland on Twitter, and you can follow the show at TopTurtleMMA.
All right, with the heavy lifting out of the way, you know what? Let's just get it into it like this. There were a bunch of fights on Saturday night, and nothing really fucking matters other than the co-main event, which is Miesha Tate claimed the bantamweight title by defeating Holly Holm in dramatic fashion in the fifth round with a rear naked choke, put Holly to sleep. She couldn't even tap. She was trying to, but she fell asleep before she could. And then, of course, in the main event, Conor McGregor, Nate Diaz at 170 pounds. Nate Diaz outboxed Conor McGregor. So badly did he outbox him that Conor shot in for a takedown, and it was night-night nurse from there. The Gracie black belt Nate Diaz was able to slip in a rear naked choke on Conor McGregor.
So let me jump in just for a second here, because I really want your opinion. And actually, I'm getting this from my dad, if I'm going to be honest. So I was talking with my dad about the fight, who watches MMA from time to time.
And he also hunts bears.
He also hunts bears, moose, caribou. Yeah, he's the woodsman type, lives in a log cabin in the woods. Definitely not making this up. So he asked me, he goes, you know, I was watching the fight, and afterwards I thought to myself, McGregor outboxed the hell out of Diaz. And I looked at him and I go, but Dad, you know, Diaz knocked him down. You know, Diaz had him wobbly, you know, and we're going to talk about the jiu-jitsu that happens later too. But I think largely why he got the submission was he got a submission with his boxing.
Okay, so I'm so glad you said that, because one of the things I wanted to talk about, and let's just get it out of the way right now, there's some bullshit coming out of the, I guess you could call it, MMA universe takeaways from Saturday night. And here are two of my big bullshit takeaways from Saturday night. One, Conor McGregor's jiu-jitsu sucks. Is it world class? No. He was, after being wobbled, he did escape. Diaz grabbed his chin, almost looked like he was trying to set up like a guillotine from mount. Conor got like an underhook, was able to escape it. I'm not saying Conor McGregor's good at jiu-jitsu, but I'm not judging Conor McGregor's jiu-jitsu. He was done.
He was very groggy. And I think the reason why he gave up his back, it was kind of a lazy give up of his back. But I think when you're stunned that much, the guy's dropping down punches, he's looking for arms, he's looking for guillotines, that's a last-ditch resort. And especially if your, like, mind's not in the right place, that's completely normal. You can't judge him for that.
Yeah, I'm not being a Conor apologist here. I happen to like Conor a lot. I wanted him to win. But you know what? Listen, Nate Diaz is the better all-around MMA fighter, I would say, because he's better in more
in
places.
All facets.
In all facets, right? It's like GSP's book. He talked about rather than being, you know, a 10 at striking and a 5 at grappling, he'd rather be a 7, a 7, a 7 across the board, right? Be pretty good at everything and then dictate where the fight can go based on your opponent's weakness.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think in both, actually, the co-main events, I think Miesha Tate is a better all-around MMA fighter than Holly Holm.
We'll get to that. Let's stay on Conor, because I could talk for days about that co-main too.
And Nate Diaz is a better all-around MMA fighter than Conor, even if you want to say Conor's the better striker, which you can't really even say anymore.
Well, well so
So that's lit him the fuck up.
That's the point I want to go back to. So I was talking to my dad, and my dad said, you know, it looked like Conor got the best of the boxing. And, you know, I went back and watched that first round, and I do believe Conor got the best of the boxing
in round one.
Yeah. So here's what happened. So he got the best of the boxing in round one because his head movement was on point. He kept slipping jabs, and he kept landing after slipping the jabs. And he knew he was hitting Diaz. If you look at Diaz's face is effed up.
Yeah.
You know, Diaz is still bloody
today. The Diaz brothers are notorious for having very thin...
Okay,
scar tissue. They get cut up easily, but I do agree with you that he was tagging him.
Yeah. I mean, he was slipping and tagging him, and I think what happened to Conor was he got so confident that he was able to tag him whenever he wanted, and what he did was he stopped moving his head after he was hitting. He was not slipping the jab and landing. He was just trying to land. And that's when he got hit. And I think after that, I mean, you can throw the rest of the fight out the window after that, in my opinion, because you weren't watching Conor McGregor after that. After he got tagged, you were watching somebody different because he started throwing those weird spinning kicks. He tried to shoot a takedown. That's not the Conor McGregor we've ever seen.
Well, yeah.
It's Woozy Conor.
That was Woozy Conor. So let me go back. We're just going to be all over the place, people. Just stick with us. So I wanted to talk about two things. One, let's not judge Conor's jiu-jitsu. It was a moment of panic. He was wobbled, as we said. That conversation I just don't even want to have right now. It's for another day. I'm not saying he's good at jiu-jitsu. It's just now's not the time to really be judging his fucking technique on the ground. He was wobbled. End of story.
Against a Gracie black belt, too. A very high-level Gracie black belt.
And this was the other bullshit thing that came out of Saturday night before we get back to the actual fight analyzation, and that is that Dana White goes on the post-fight presser and says, I think a fight that makes sense is Nate Diaz versus Robbie Lawler at 170. And I'm like... Huh? What? Whoa. Wait, hold on. First of all, let's get this out of our heads that this fight was at welterweight. It was two lightweight fighters who just happened to both weigh 170 pounds.
At the time of the fight.
At the time of the fight, which is what they'd probably weigh if they did the cut the day before. And then they would have gained some weight, and they'd both be walking in around 168, 170. This idea that now Nate Diaz, I don't even think qualifies for the lightweight title shot right now because RDA already beat him. He qualifies for the welterweight title shot because he beat the featherweight champion at 170 pounds. That makes zero sense.
All right, so I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit here, and I'm going to tell you why it does make some sense. In the world of deserving an MMA UFC title shot, I agree with you. It makes no sense whatsoever for Nate Diaz to fight Robbie Lawler. In a UFC promoter head, you do not get too many chances to capitalize on this kind of momentum.
Right.
And right now, you've got Nate Diaz, who you could sell against anybody.
Could you say he's a needle mover?
He's a needle mover now. He has solidified himself as a needle mover, but I don't know about for how long.
For those who might not be aware, 2 years ago during a contract negotiation, Dana White famously said that Nate Diaz was not a needle mover. And
yeah.
He moved the needle now.
He is going to, but I don't think for long. Like, okay, so say he is a lightweight. Say he's a 155er.
I consider him a 155er.
You consider him. So in my mind, if I was trying to figure out the 155 title picture, I had to choose what I thought was right. I give the winner of Ferguson and Khabib Nurmagomedov the fight against RDA.
Yeah.
And so then I got to figure out what to do with Diaz. So Diaz...
Eddie Alvarez.
You would give him to Eddie Alvarez. What is Eddie Alvarez going to do to Nate Diaz?
He's going to wrestle box him.
He's going to dirty box him. He's going to put him up against the cage. He's probably going to do the same thing that Anthony Pettis did. Does that fight sell ticket? Would you watch Eddie Alvarez, Nate Diaz if it was headlining a pay-per-view?
You could take my money now. Yeah, I would.
Really? You would? Yeah. I wouldn't watch it. And
really? For the boxing aspect.
I mean, part of it to me is just
they're
that,
both really good boxers.
I mean, but do you think Eddie Alvarez is going to stand with him and box him?
No, I think he's probably going to grind him up against the cage.
I just watched a fight with Anthony Pettis and Eddie Alvarez that I considered boring. I considered an Anthony Pettis fight for the first time in my life boring, and it was because he was fighting Eddie Alvarez. And Eddie Alvarez knows he's about this close to getting a title shot, and if you put him in there against Nate Diaz, you don't think he's going to fight super, super, super safe?
I guess, yeah. No, I'm with you. You're completely correct in saying that. I still would watch it, though, because I think it would be fun to see them stand and bang, and then when Alvarez goes to the wrestle fuck mentality up against the cage, I mean, Diaz is great off his back with submissions. I don't know.
I mean, that's true. But to me, if I'm the UFC and I'm trying to get every penny out of this Nate Diaz hype train that just started up, I think it's a waste to go to somebody like Eddie Alvarez next. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to give him Robbie Lawler. That being said, okay, so here's another fun situation to think about, right? Nate Diaz's boxing looks sweet, right?
It looked amazing.
His ground game, always entertaining.
On point, okay? As the kids say.
Now, if we can't put him in with Robbie Lawler because we know that's a travesty, what if we give Robbie Lawler the person he was supposed to have all along, Tyrone Woodley, and we give our new hotshot, although he was just booked with Rory McDonald, which is kind of disappointing.
Oh, you're going to say Stephen Wonderboy Thompson.
What if you gave him Stephen Wonderboy Thompson?
That's fun matchmaking.
God,
just,
how much fun would that be?
I'm just envisioning Stephen Wonderboy Thompson knocking his head clean off into the third row. But
you don't know that it would happen, because that's what I thought Connor was going to do.
That is a good match. But yeah, they just booked Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Rory for some Canadian show in like mid-June.
But God, how fun would that be?
That's a good one.
You would watch that in a second. It would capitalize on two guys with momentum. And I'm not saying that Eddie Alvarez doesn't have momentum, but it's not the same kind of momentum. You know what I mean?
Yeah, agreed. Now, I want to go back to the fight itself, because we were talking about it in the second round. And just for my own, I guess you could call it, clarification in my head, I watched it again today, and I wrote down blow by blow everything that happened. And I'm not going to bore our listenership.
That's some pretty in-depth shit right there.
Yeah. And
he emailed it to me at work, and I was like, hey, that's some shit right there.
But I wanted to just see it all on paper and just see like what Connor was trying to do. And here's the thing, the spin kicks, he said it in the post-fight press conference, it was a waste of his energy. And I'm counting up here, just looking at it, I bolded all the spin kicks in this list of every move that happened. And it looks like he threw 4 spin kicks that landed in air.
Yeah.
And so there was that. And then the second thing was he kept looking for that left. This is in round 2 now I'm talking about. He kept looking for that left and it missed by a mile, the left cross that put out a lot of featherweights. And it wasn't there against Nate Diaz because of his head movement. And right there, again, energy spent. I agree with that. I think his right after the fight, he's giving crisp analyzation. I think he was dead on. Yeah. You know, I think he wasted a lot of energy.
And I think too, the difference between that left landing flush and knocking somebody cold like he's done so many times before, whether it's Chad Mendez or Jose Aldo or guys he fought before he got to the UFC. I mean, if you haven't seen some of those knockouts, you should. I think it's the difference between those guys and Nate Diaz is Nate Diaz's boxing head movement. That punch is going to land so less often. Like, you know, Diaz knows how to move his head when that punch is thrown, and he sees it earlier than those other guys,
I gotta
too.
I got to give him credit in the lead up when we're all laughing, just LOLing left and right at the lead up to this fight, at the press conferences, and Connor's such a funny guy, balloon animals in his left hand. I loved it. I ate it up with a spoon, as we said last week. But Diaz kept saying, who do you train with? Because I train with Joe Schilling, the famous kickboxer. I train with Kron fucking Gracie for my jiu-jitsu. I spar with Andre Ward, the boxer. And you know what? He was dead on.
Yeah, but you know what, though? So here's the other thing. So you're talking about hating the keyboard warriors who were saying what they were saying about this fight. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people be like, well, you had to trust Diaz because you're right. He trains with all these people and they've used that excuse. But, like, in the same token, he's always done that. And if we watched him lose, like, bullshit fights, yeah, we have. The reason we didn't trust him wasn't because we thought his training partners were trash.
That's a good point.
The reason we didn't trust him was because we watched Josh Thompson kick his head off once.
Well, and
then, it's Josh Thompson, and who now fights for Bellator.
And also he just did not come into shape in that RDA fight. I don't think he gave a fuck. I think that was right after the contract negotiation that he wasn't happy about. You know, I think in my head I was thinking of that Nate Diaz. Although when he came back against Michael Johnson in December, he was he looked great, you know, coming off that fight. I don't know. Yeah, you're right, though.
Really,
you're right.
It's really hard to get in the head of a Diaz brother. Who knows what they're thinking? You know, I've heard these different conspiracy theories out there that they're like super geniuses just act that way.
I think so.
You think they're a super genius?
I think there's like actually sort of like a marketing team behind them. They both wear black shirts and jeans all the time. That's like a gimmick of theirs,
but
right?
I think that's like a Stockton thing.
The way they curse. Like Ronda Rousey's mom said that one of the most respectful and nice people Ronda's ever introduced her to were the Diaz brothers.
That's freaking great.
Yeah. Like,
but she also said that, she said that Ronda's trainer was pretty much Hitler once too. So
I mean
I don't know what the guy's like, but I think comparing him to like one of the most violent dictators in history is probably a little much.
It runs his mom a little over the top. But point being, I do think there is somewhat of a gimmick to the Diaz brothers, and I like them a lot. But
I mean, I would agree that they're definitely playing it up a little bit, but I agree. They probably are a little bit more intelligent than they
will let on. No,
yeah, they're not like street boys from Stockton. They're from Stockton. They've punched some people in the streets before, but they're like a little bit smarter than they lead on.
Now, here's something I wanted to bring up. I don't know if this kind of struck a chord with you at all, but I was thinking about it. In all the lead up and hype and the shit talk that went back and forth, day of the fight, you know, they're introducing them in the ring, and I was kind of expecting like more shit talking across the cage, Diaz throwing up a middle finger, maybe Connor throwing up a middle finger. And they definitely, like when they were boxing with each other, I even have it here in my notes. Like, let me just read you three lines. Gumby, okay, this won't bore you that much. Connor hits a lead left uppercut, Diaz bunches up, Connor lands another left to the head, semi-blocked by Diaz's right hand. Nate says what's up and hits Connor with a straight right. Connor's stupid spin kick goes nowhere. Anyway, but they were like jawing with each other after they would tag each other, but I thought there would be more. Like, Diaz in the post-fight press conference and in the Joe Rogan Octagon interview, he could have said like, how's my kid's jiu-jitsu class now, maybe you should take it. There wasn't a lot of that. I mean, sure, there's mutual respect and I get it and the fight's over, but I don't know, part of me now leaves the week thinking a lot of the lead up was just kind of like a put on.
I think it was a put on, and you know, we always talk about that. We've talked about whether or not Faber Dillashaw actually have a beef. We've talked about 100 of those different conspiracy theories. I think this was one that you know, McGregor amped up the talk, but he's always had respect for the Diaz brothers.
Yeah.
You know, and the one thing I will say about the Diaz brothers, they could be as vulgar as you want them to be in the cage, but always right after a fight, they're like the nicest guys on the planet.
And Connor's the same way, not on the vulgar side, but like he'll talk down to his opponents, what have you. Until he beats them. And then even like when Aldo was damn near crying in the cage, he went over to him and said something very respectful, I'm sure. And you know, you could just tell. I think a lot of people kind of know that about Connor, but anyway,
people forget that about the Diaz brothers, though, because the one that always sticks in my head is when Nick beat BJ Penn.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of trash talk leading up to the fight. I mean, he flips off BJ Penn. It's like a bloody war. He beat BJ Penn within an inch of his life, I think.
Yeah.
That was the most beat up I've seen a guy in the cage in a long time, having not been knocked out.
Right.
Except for maybe Paige VanZant when Rose Namajunas got a hold of her.
Yeah.
You know, he beat him with an inch of his life. And then there's these great pictures of them like arm in arm.
Same thing against Anderson Silva, right? Silva, after the fight, because he just come back from a horrific injury, you know, took sexual enhancers to heal that injury, what have you. But at the end of the fight, he's crying in the cage, and Nick goes and picks him up and says, don't cry. And
yeah, that's the point where you're like, yeah, they're not as big of thugs as they put on, I think.
All right.
And I think to answer the other part of your question there about why there is not more in the cage, because they are always respectful afterwards, but your question about why there's not more in the cage, I think the answer there comes with the fact that they were both nervous of each other's skills.
Yeah.
I think McGregor realized what he was doing at 170 was a little crazy, you know, and I know Diaz knew how good he was.
Yeah.
And I think both of them knew that and were a little bit afraid, because the one thing I will say about Connor too is Connor is always brash and in your face when he's sure. In the cage, when he's talking shit in the cage, it's because he knows he got you.
Yeah.
When he started stalking down, you know, Chad Mendez with that look on his face, it was because he knew Chad had nothing left. When he was talking shit to Seaver, it's because he knew Seaver couldn't stop anything he was doing. So I think he gets cocky like that in talking. Same with Diaz. I think Diaz gets cocky and is talking when either you're frustrating him by not being active enough or he knows he's got you.
Right. That's a great point.
So I think they both knew that they didn't have each other.
So here's another thing, I guess, just in retrospect, I wanted to bring up too is I really do think reach played a huge factor in this. Diaz, awesome boxing skills, head movement, etc. You know, I think back now on all the guys Connor fought, maybe except Poirier. I have to just think off the top of my head, Poirier and him probably have about an equal reach. They seem about the same height at least. But, you know, it's like Seaver, Mendez, Diego Brandao, Marcus Brimage. These are all smaller people than Connor.
Yeah, the other thing you got to look for too in reach, and I've always been a very, very big criticizer of reach and using it to analyze stuff, because when you look at reach, they measure your chest. I mean, one of the biggest reaches in MMA history was Brock Lesnar, and Brock Lesnar had T-Rex arms.
Right.
The guy barely had any length in his arms at all, but he had like an 83-inch reach because his chest was so big. And I think while some of those guys reach is probably in Connor's range. You're right. They're all bigger chested guys who have shorter arms, right? Dennis Seaver, he probably has a decent reach, but he's got that like weirdly bulky chest. Same with Chad Mendes.
Right.
Chad Mendes, probably shorter arms and like a bigger chest. He's got the wrestler build. Okay. So all of those guys that you mentioned might be in his range and reach, but Diaz, I mean, the guy barely has a chest. Mm-hmm. He's just all arms and legs,
he's
right?
He's gangly. Gangly yeah. is the word.
He looks like Gumby.
The actual Gumby.
The actual Gumby, yeah. Not me. No. I don't look like Nate Diaz.
Well, so that's fair. And then, well, I guess this would be the other thing I'd say about Connor fighting the smaller people. You know, when that left hits and connects, it's night, nurse. It's lights out. And, you know, maybe at 155, guys are just a touch heavier, bigger. That's not the case. Although, you know what? Poirier is doing great at 155 right now, and Connor clipped him. But that was kind of a weird one, too.
I think all of that kind of stuff comes down to, though, when you see people change weight classes and you're trying to decide whether or not they can take a punch at this class or this class, I think a lot of that boils down to whether or not the gas tank is there, too. Because Poirier said it himself. When he was down at 145, he didn't feel good. He never felt good. He's back to 155. He feels great. He looks great. He looks dangerous. You know, lining up matchups near the top of the division for him. So that kind of stuff is largely dependent on the person, I think.
And so two more things I want to bring up about where McGregor kind of goes from here. One being, I don't know, this is just a quick hitter, but did he get a little out of control with the weight gain, knowing that he didn't have to do the cut to 145? Because I did think, like, you know, watching the fight a second time, they're tagging each other a little bit. We all know Diaz doesn't have the most power in the world. It's punches and bunches. It's volume. But I was kind of surprised, you know, Connor lets his hands down. Again, it's after getting hit in the face. So there is that factor. But part of me did wonder, like, is this a cardio thing? Did he gain a little too much muscle? Did you think that at all? Or not?
I didn't think cardio. And as a matter of fact, as far as the gaining of muscle, you know, I was on an MMA website. I won't mention the name, but I was on it and they were like, you know, see the difference between 145 and 170, Connor. And I was like, well, you got me with your clickbait. So I clicked on it and they showed the two pictures and I was like, it didn't really look like much. I mean, his muscles look bigger, but only in the way that it didn't look like all the shit around it was sucked down.
Was this weigh-in or
weigh-in?
Okay.
Yeah, it was at weigh-ins. Yeah. But I don't think he cut that much to get to 170. You know, and I looked
I think he walks around at like 178.
Yeah,
so next to nothing.
I like looked at the picture side by side, and you know, when those guys cut large amounts of weight, you know, their muscles look extra cut. You can see all the veins and shit like that. You can see that at 145 and you can't see it at 170, but other than that, I didn't see a large difference in his size. I mean, I think there's some, but I don't think that was it. I think he probably would have a better cardio. I mean, I think just in the end, he got tagged.
So where I kind of leave it too is I'm so glad the Connor at 170 discussion is probably over, but I'd still like to see him at 155. And I think he could come back to that. Now, do you agree with that? I think he could live at 155 and maybe not dominate. But
I'm interested in seeing him at 155, but not now. You know, I want to see him go down there and I want to see him clean his division out.
Yeah.
Go prove to me that you really are the best at 45. I mean, we've seen a handful of his fights at 45, but two against elite guys. Two against elite
and
145.
Are you talking about Mendes being the second
I'm
elite?
Talking about Mendes.
And Mendes was on 11 days notice.
I mean, So he has two fights against elite featherweights. And, you know, already we were talking about him being like a 3 or 4 division champion. I mean, like, we needed to pump the brakes a little bit, I think. And I'm glad that if there's one thing that we can take out of this is that we can put the 170-pound title to rest for a while.
Stop.
And I think we should put the 155-pound title to rest.
And isn't that kind of unfortunate in a way? Because it's almost, I don't know if ironic's the word, but, you know, RDA backed out of the fight because he broke his foot. 155-pound title, champion.
Now, did you see the pictures of that, too, by the way? Anybody calling that BS is crazy. It looked like a goddamn balloon.
Yeah. No, agreed. And Connor could have been like the majority of other UFC fighters and, you know, said, no, I'm not going to do it. But he stuck in the game and they went and got Nate Diaz, which arguably might end up being a bigger pay-per-view buy rate. But it's almost, I don't know what the word is, but it's like he actually kind of gets a little punished for it because I agree with you. He shouldn't fight for the 155-pound title after losing to Nate Diaz. So it's one of these rare occasions where, like, he's stuck in the game and actually gets punished for it.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But, like, I don't know. I think in the end, the way he handled himself, his popularity didn't go anywhere. I mean, he handled himself like a real champ when he lost.
Did you see his Instagram post?
I don't believe I saw the Instagram one.
Let me just read this out loud.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
It's amazing, and I think it speaks to kind of his character. It's great. I stormed in, I put it all on the line, I took a shot and missed. I'll never apologize for taking a shot. Shit happens. I'll take the loss like a man. I will not shy away from it. I will not change who I am. If another champion goes up two weights, let me know. If you're tired of me talking money, take a nap. I'll still be here when you wake up with the highest pay-per-view in gate. Still talking multi-sevens. Should I do this in his accent, by the way?
No, okay. Never do his accent. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you to the true support and fuck the hate that came out of the woodwork. I love it all. It's still steak for breakfast. I've been here many times in my life in some form or another. I'll eat it all. Come back stronger. Aldo, you are a pussy. Dos Anjos, you are a pussy. When the history books are written, I showed up. You showed up on Twitter. To the fans, never shy away from challenges. Never run from adversity. Face yourself head on. Nate, I will see you again.
I gotta comment on one piece of that. So first of all, brilliant. Exactly what I said. He's a huge, huge man, and he just takes that exactly the way that everybody should take a loss. And what we talked about before, people lose in MMA.
All the time.
And we need to treat it like it's not the end of the world, and he treated it like it's not the end of the world. So that's the first part. The second part, I gotta comment on the F Aldo in there too, because it made me laugh, because Aldo, I definitely saw a tweet from Aldo, like, shortly after McGregor lost.
Which he didn't write, his management wrote.
I assume his management wrote.
It was like, yeah, I'll see you at 200,
did you see the one, yeah, that said he was fighting at 200? And then it trash-talked Frankie Edgar, saying Frankie Edgar didn't deserve it.
Jeez.
And it was just like, yeah, it was funny, because it was clearly like his management team was like, we gotta get on this. His hype train's still alive, and he's gotta come back to 140. He doesn't have a chance. Let's get this. There's no way you can talk me out of believing that Frankie Edgar deserves that title shot. God, that guy is waiting so long for the Conor McGregor.
So, you know, it's funny. If you go back to our first episode, we both said two prophetic things, and I'm going to pat us on the back because we're new to the MMA podcast world, and we need to hype ourselves up sometimes, be our own Conor McGregor. But I actually said I gave Misha a really good chance against Holly because I thought she could shoot from the outside, get a double leg, take her down, and dominate her on the ground.
That's impressive, because I didn't believe you.
And you said, this is in our first episode, you said, I really have a feeling Frankie's going to get screwed over here.
Oh,
and you know what? I think Frankie's going to get screwed over here, because I almost feel like the UFC told Aldo's management, start talking shit right now. Like, that's a better money-making fight. I hate to say it, because I'm on your train. Like, let's see Frankie versus Conor. Frankie deserves it. But if they need to book a big fight for 200 and kind of maybe assure Conor has a guy who's not just going to wrestle fuck him the whole time, it's Aldo. That should be the...
You think Aldo is like a better selling fight than McGregor right now?
I think Aldo's a better selling fight than Frankie Edgar.
You really think so?
Yeah, because he brings in the Brazilian fans, and he's the former champion of 9 years. And here's the other thing. Frankie Edgar, don't get me wrong, I want to see Frankie Edgar better.
I think Frankie Edgar sells way better.
And I don't think
here's
so.
Here's why, too. Because you're saying the Brazilian fans are Brazilian fans. There's going to be a famous Brazilian on that UFC 200 card. Conor's already said he's going to be ready for UFC 200. There's going to be a famous Brazilian on that card that Brazilians are going to want to see anyway. Anderson Silva could be back by then. Why not Anderson Silva on that card?
But I'm just talking about Frankie versus Aldo. I think Aldo brings a bigger fan base. I think that's the bigger fight. And he's talking shit. Hey, listen, if you want to go by Twitter, because Aldo has twice the amount of Twitter followers as Frankie Edgar.
I mean, I agree with that, too. But, like, I don't know. I think that was probably just him being champ for a while. Frankie brings that whole East Coast base. I don't know. There's just something about Frankie Edgar. Yeah, he's not really a good trash talker. But I bet you 90% of those Twitter followers on, maybe not 90, I'm exaggerating. I bet you all of those Twitter followers for Aldo, though, came when he was talking with Conor. You know, like, you probably...
But that's to the point. I mean, I think Irish fans are incensed by Aldo. Frankie Edgar is not talking shit, and we know you have to talk shit.
But I don't think you can sell this guy who just lost in 13 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, he did sell the fight. You're right. They did a great job of selling it. He's got all these followers now. People loved it and ate it with a spoon. But it's kind of come and gone to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's not...
I mean, I'll watch either. Don't get me wrong. We will get in a more in-depth discussion on the UFC 200 possibilities later in the show. The last thing I do just want to say about this whole Conor Diaz fallout is... and you could give me your quick take on this. I'm so glad the Connor versus Lawler talk is over. And I was thinking back in my head when it was all about would Rousey retire undefeated and, hey, could she fight with Floyd Mayweather? That was kind of like the clickbait of 2015, right?
And 14, probably.
And 14. And, you know, the clickbait of 2016 is just Connor's going to go up and wait and he'll challenge for the welterweight title. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, these two, like, the hype train on both of them is, and I get it, don't get me wrong, I mean, they sell fights, it's awesome, but like, John Jones is just sitting here. He's the best fighter of our generation, and
I would go on, and we always say we're gonna have this conversation, but I will go on record saying that I believe John Jones is the greatest fighter of all time.
So you know what, let's next week, is there a show next week that we're gonna be previewing?
Yeah, there is, Hunt and Mir.
Yeah, you're right, Hunt and Mir. All right,
friend of the show, Mark Hunt, we gotta give him his due time.
But there are some weeks coming up here where there are no shows, I think, between that and then into the Fox card, so that should be the week we finally have our John Jones is the greatest ever and make our case.
Yep.
And that'll be our version of clickbait. Not that we're going out on a huge limb, but I mean, it just, you know, it doesn't get talked about enough, and there might even be a bit of a race angle there too. He should be venerated, to use an SAT word, way more so than he is.
Yeah, I agree. So speaking of best in their division or best in their class, this weekend is World Series of Fighting 29, Justin Gaethje versus Brian Foster. And we got a chance to sit down with the president of World Series of Fighting, you know,
Ray Sefo,
super nice guy. He was actually a fighter in World Series of Fighting, and he talks a little bit about how he's, you know, he's not retired.
He still gets the itch.
He's not retired. So, keeping those possibilities open.
So this interview is brought to you by New England Submission Fighting. New England Submission Fighting, a mixed martial arts gym in the lovely college town of Amherst, Massachusetts. Gumby trains there. I train there. Class is 6 days a week. No-gi grappling, no-gi jiu-jitsu, what you want to call it, is the specialty, but there are also stand-up striking classes for MMA on Tuesday and Wednesday nights. If you are in the area, southern Vermont, northern Connecticut, or anywhere in the Western Mass area, you are doing yourself a disservice if you are not coming by NESF and training there.
Top-notch training partners, top-notch instruction. You really can't get any better, not in this area at least.
All right. So with that said, NESF, New England Submission Fighting, brings you our interview with World Series of Fighting President Ray Sefo.
This is Daniel Gumby Vreeland here with my co-host Dave Tremonti with Top Turtle MMA. I am here with Ray Sefo, the president of World Series of Fighting. World Series Fighting's latest offering is on this Saturday, April 12th. How are we doing today, Ray?
I'm good, thank you, and thank you for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. So, you're in fight week here. What are going on for the last second preparations, and what are you guys up to as of right now?
Well, fight week is always, you know, really hectic. Everybody's on the go from the PR team to our production team to the guys in the office to our partners. You know, it's just a go week.
Well, we certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. So let's talk about a couple of the fighters on the card. So the main event is between Justin Gaethje and Brian Foster. Justin Gaethje has been seen as like one of the big names in that weight class that's not signed to the UFC. Where do you think he stands amongst lightweights there?
I think he's one of the best lightweights in the world today. I mean, he's the world champion for a reason. And he's the World Series of Fighting world champion at that. And so, you know, I think he was, anybody that wants to stand and bang with Justin Gaethje, I think Justin's going to put them away. You know, the guy's a collegiate wrestler. He's amazing on the ground. He's got a great takedown defense. So, I mean, you know, I match him with the best of the best, and he ranks up there.
We certainly look forward to watching him because he's never really in a boring fight. Let's talk about some of the other guys in the card, too. So you got Brian Foster there who's fighting against him. What challenges does Brian Foster pose to, you know, one of your self-proclaimed best in the world at lightweight?
Well, Brian Foster is, you know, he's proven that he's a force to be reckoned with as well. Coming out, and when you win a three-man tournament after being defeated in your first fight, had the opportunity to come back, and then you win the whole tournament, nothing gets you more ready for a Justin Gaethje than winning a three fights in one night. And you know, Justin Gaethje is, there's no secret what he does. He's relentless. He's powerful. He's strong. He can take you down. He can slam you. He can, you know, he can knock you out. He can submit you. So, I mean, the guy brings that kind of game. But what makes him even more dangerous is because of his work rate, and that he does it at. He just never stops. He's just, you know, he's like an energy bunny. And Brian Foster, on the other hand, he's kind of like the precise guy, very dangerous, also very good on the ground. So, you know, I think it makes it for a real interesting match because two style of fighters. What Foster's going to be and hoping that he's ready for is a pace that goes from the – with Justin Gaethje, there's no warming up. When that bell rings, he's fighting. You know what I mean? And so it's hard for a lot of people to kind of get used to that kind of pace where that's how he fights. And so I think that's probably the biggest obstacle that Brian would have to, you know, be aware of. But other than that, Brian's been in there with some of the best. And so he knows what it takes to be, you know, to get the job done.
Yeah, and, you know, as they say, styles make matchups. So, right. You know, to talk a little bit about Brian Foster, too, as you mentioned, he was in that crazy 8-man lightweight tournament and, you know, lost his first fight, came back as an alternate, and wound up winning the whole thing. You know, absolutely craziness with a couple of injuries there, you know, some rematches within the same night. Would World Series of Fighting ever consider doing something like that again?
Oh, absolutely! I think it's. I think the fans love it. We love it, and I think it. You know, it really sits a statement. I fought in tournaments many years, and it puts you in a completely different category of, you know, when you fight three times in one night.
Yeah, and so back to speaking about you fighting a little bit. So you fought for your own promotion in the past. With some of the older guys who've been getting into the cage recently, I mean. You know, Kimbo, Hoist Gracie, Ken Shamrock. Do you ever feel that itch to get back in the cage, whether it's your own or another company's cage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've never retired, and that's because I'm in the gym 6 days a week. So, you know, I said last year that time it's getting closer and closer where, you know, I would have to say, but. You know, I'm in the gym, and when I move around with guys that are 24 and still, you know, put it on them and be quicker and whatever, I mean, that still tells me that I can compete, you know, with still compete and still fight. So, and I'm still hungry and passionate about competing. So if there was ever a opportunity to fight those guys, yeah, absolutely.
Switching gears, Ray, curious, today you guys released on your website that you had signed a strategic agreement for South Africa MMA, a promotion in South Africa. Just curious what that's all about. Is this going to be a new a funnel for talent to World Series of Fighting, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's things that we've talked about from the beginning. Obviously, for us, we want to grow the brand here in the U.S. and slowly go globally. And, you know, if it means that we got to do it at a certain level, yeah, absolutely. But that's been the goal from day one. Obviously, is to build the brand, build Words of Fighting in the U.S., and then slowly expand out.
Talking a little bit about partnerships here. So, you know, you guys have been working with NBC Sports for quite some time here in the U.S., and we've gotten to see, you know, a lot of the fights live. However, a lot of the companies are switching to streaming services. We've seen like four or five companies in the past start to work with the UFC. You guys certainly have not been adverse to working with the UFC in regards to like contracts in the past. Is that something that World Series of Fighting, whether with the UFC or in other streaming devices, has considered doing?
You know, I mean, that's there's some discussions going on right now that I can't go into. In terms of streaming, we always, from day one, we've streamed our fights worldwide anyway.
That's very true. Yeah. No, I meant more as like as part of like a streaming service, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah. You give us the free content anyway, which is awesome.
Right.
We always appreciate that. So Ray, just from a promoter standpoint, obviously this past weekend, big news in the MMA world, Nate Diaz beating Conor McGregor. I'm guessing you saw it. Yes.
I was there live, yes.
Okay, perfect. And, you know, I'm curious if you could put your promoter's hat on for a second. What would you do with Conor McGregor if you were the UFC? Would you book him back at featherweight, make him defend his title? How would you, let's say, rebuild his stock, so to speak? You know, not that it went super down, but he obviously has to rebuild a little credibility. He wouldn't want two losses in a row. What would you do with him if you were the UFC?
Yeah, I would absolutely put him, Conor's it himself. He most likely would probably go back to his 145 title. Is it 145?
Yeah, 145.
Right? Yep. Yeah, and defend that. And, obviously Frankie Edgar would be in line for that. And which Frankie Edgar is not an easy fight for anybody.
No joke.
You know
there.
What I mean? And so that's a big one. I don't know. All I know is that when you talk the talk, you got to understand to what level you can take that talk to. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can't call out all the different weight classes when you haven't dominated your own weight class yet. It's a different story if Conor had dominated the whole division and there was nobody to fight, and then, you know, decides to go up to another division and then decides, you know, then that makes sense. But when you just won the title and then you're calling out all these other divisions, well, I mean, you know, he took a gamble and it bit him in the backside.
You know, I'm going to switch back quickly to World Series of Fighting here. You guys have had a little bit of back and forth in your 170-pound division between Jake Shields, John Fitch, and obviously Usman Paul Harris. So Paul Harris currently is under suspension for holding on to a submission too late. Is when that suspension does expire, do you expect to see him in the World Series of Fighting cage again, or is that something that you'll have to make a decision on down the road?
Yeah, that's something that, that's a bridge we'll cross when we get to it. But right now, most likely will be. But right now, I don't even know where his mindset is, what he wants to do. I mean, for all I know, he might want to fight anymore by the time the suspension is on. I have no idea.
Ray, we really appreciate the time today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you guys.
All right, so there you have it. Ray Sefo Gumby, he was very open with us, and he has a unique perspective because he's a former fighter and now he's a promoter.
And, you know, fun card this weekend in a weekend that has no UFC. I'm going to tune into that one because, A, I love Justin Gaethje. He's right. He's definitely a top lightweight. I'm not necessarily sure he's number one, but he's a top lightweight. And I love Josh the Cuddly Bear Copeland, former UFC heavyweight there, who's just in a fun fight to watch this weekend, too.
All right, so we talked so much about Nate and Conor. We didn't even get to the co-main event in our show open, and now it's time. Let's talk about it.
Can I kick this one off?
Go for it.
I got it. So I was posing this question to everybody who is watching the fights with me. So I went and watched the fights at my best friend's house. Sat down drinking and watching some really, really awesome fights. And I asked the question as soon as that fight was over. I turned to everybody and I go, you have a ballot in front of you right now. Who is the best women's bantamweight fighter in the world? So I know who has the title. Right. I know who has the title. That's not what I'm asking. Who is the best women's bantamweight fighter in the world? Dave Tremonti.
Wow. So it's interesting because I think to myself, by definition, it's Misha Tate because she has the title and she just beat the Queen Slayer, Holly Holm. But I think Ronda beats Misha and I think Holly beats Ronda.
It's like a beautiful women's bantamweight rock, paper, scissors.
Yes.
Yes. And it's even more so than just they beat each other, but they have exactly what they need to beat the other
one. The antidote to the other person's strength.
They have like a blueprint written out that only they can execute to beat the other one, right? Like Holly definitely had a little bit of trouble with double leg takedowns and getting up from bottom control. Ronda had trouble getting in on the footwork of a boxer, and Misha's grappling did not work against somebody who could manipulate her weight to throw her around.
Talking about Ronda.
Yeah, talking about Ronda. I mean, like, these three have each other's kryptonite.
It's awesome.
And it's awesome because these three have, like, countless fights in front of them where this is going to be exciting, right? We're going to see, you know, what if Ronda walks in and beats Misha?
And then, okay, so you give the next shot to Holm because she's got to win over Ronda.
Yes.
And she beats Ronda again. And then what happens? You have to go to Misha?
Right.
So then Misha beats her? Meanwhile, there are people like Amanda Nunes who had a pretty nice win this week.
That was another... Oh, this was my other thing. We talked about some of the bullshit coming out of that fight where everyone's like, oh, the undercard was so boring. And it's like, yeah, you know, Lawler and Corey Anderson, not the greatest fight in the history of the world. And Gian Vellante, Aliyah Latifi, I thought would be way more exciting because we were all expecting the knockout. But yeah. Hey, guess what, people? I like that Amanda Nunes fight. I thought it was a gritty performance by Shevchenko to come back after clearly losing that first round, right?
And I had picked Nunes to win, so I was like a little bit on pins and needles in that third round because it seemed like
that was a fun fight.
She might have gotten finished in that third round. I was getting a little worried.
That was a fun fight, and Nunes is a contender at the top. And hey, Kat Zingano's out there too.
Oh, do you forget about Kat Zingano? You forget about is it Juliana Pena?
Yeah, Juliana Pena. Right.
So I mean, like, there are legitimate options at 135 who have to wait.
Do you remember all the shit talk people were doing around the fall of last year, pre-Ronda Holly, where it was just like, oh, Ronda's beating a bunch of nobodies, and that division, it's so
new. That division
new.
Is
and
one of the most intriguing
it's
to
gotten
me right
really
now.
Fun.
Well, okay, so you want to make that rock, paper, scissors game even more complicated. Kat Zingano has a win over Misha Tate.
That's right.
So
I wouldn't even mind seeing Misha defend against Kat if it's going to take Ronda a ton of time to come back.
So here's my only problem with that is that, like, I'm pretty sure Kat Zingano might have even called for it, if I'm not mistaken. She's been out for 13 months. She hasn't fought in 13 months.
Lost in 14 seconds to Ronda Rousey.
Although, what would be very intriguing, we know Ronda's getting the next shot. What would be very intriguing is Holly Holm versus Kat Zingano
in the meantime. Yeah,
I mean,
that's a great
the
matchup.
Striking there, so fun, right? That's like a great fight to watch. I'm all over it. And I just like the kryptonite of each other is just so interesting to me. Styles make fights. That's like the cliche, as cliche as we could be. But it has never been more true than right now.
And just more clear in that women's bantamweight division.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Because you're right. There have been people who have been each other's kryptonite in like a rock, paper, scissors format before, but never this clear.
So in the fight itself, you know, we'll talk about that just a little bit. Holly won via point fighting round one. And then round two, Misha took Holly down and abused the shit out of her face with some elbows, some hammer fists, and tried to lock in a rear naked choke that she couldn't get. And then Holly gets back in round three and four and kind of cruises her way just to, you know, point fighting. Misha, I think, was actually, even though the two takedowns loomed very large, she was about, I want to say, Holly defended 6 out of 8 takedowns or so. I could check on Fight Metric in a second. But the two that that Misha stuck were huge.
Were damn good.
And ultimately in the fifth round proved to be the end of the fight. So that being said, all judges had round two 10-8. For Misha.
Yeah, that's a draw if it goes to the card.
It was a draw, right? Yeah. Because if you give Misha the fifth round, and let's just say she didn't lock in the rear naked choke, or RNC, if you're a cool Jits person, we're staring at a draw, which would have felt very unsatisfactory, I think, and would have just put the title picture in even more of a state.
Oh my God, what a train wreck would that have
been,
right?
That would have been a train wreck,
because, like, you would have all of the MMA purists being like, nope, you got to give Misha the rematch.
Right.
And meanwhile, although then again, here's an argument for that. It ends in a draw. Theoretical situation. Could never happen anymore because we know what happens now. You could redo Misha Holly at UFC 200, and then one of them still ready for Rousey in November.
Yeah. So,
I mean, like, it probably wouldn't have caused as much trouble as I just let on, but still pretty crazy.
So Ronda was at a pro wrestling gorilla show on Saturday night. There are photos on the internet to prove it. Dana White went on the post-fight show and said he texted her, you know, hey, Misha won by rear naked choke. And Ronda replied, all right, I have work to do, which Dominic Cruz in the booth on the post-fight show of Fox had a great follow-up to Dana, which was work to do in which industry, Hollywood or UFC? Good follow-up, but I think she was implying
that's interesting. Yeah, I think she was implying
probably fighting,
that she was fighting.
So now I know people have already brought this up, and I'm guessing the answer is no, because Ronda had previously said she had movie commitments and she needed a year to get ready, which was fair for Holly and the striking game that Holly brings. But you think Dana White's not calling her up today being like, can you get ready for 200? It's a girl you've already beaten twice. Do you really need that much time to prepare?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. Because I think that she does need less preparation now, because, I mean,
you know, in Jeff Fox, the owner of MMA-Manifesto.com, put up an article on the where the numbers came out originally for the betting odds. And when the betting odds opened on betting sites, Ronda Rousey was a negative 1,200 favorite over Miesha Tate.
Jeez.
1,200. That means you could bet $1,200 and you win an extra $100.
Right.
On it.
Massive favorite.
Huge, huge, huge favorite here. So, like, I mean, like,
can I say something?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
All right. So, me and Miesha were like this. I was in on the fact that I thought she would match up well with Holly. I'm going to play devil's advocate for why Miesha has a okay shot in the rematch. Are you ready
okay.
for it?
You're only going to play for an okay shot.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's minus 1,200, and here's why.
Well, he did write, though, that in that article that the odds have dropped down because so many people had put money on Miesha those odds.
Right.
The odds have dropped down to, like, I think it's like negative 550 on Ronda now. But still, that's a still pretty significant favorite.
That is significant. Here's what I'd say. One, Ronda took incredible damage against Holly. So, you know, her chin could maybe be tested more so than it was in the past. Two, Hollywood has taken over her. It's almost like, you know, she's almost a different profession now. She's an actress who sometimes fights, I guess. Okay, so there's that aspect. Three, Miesha was the only girl to ever take her to the third round. No, it was the third round.
Is that third round or second?
It was the third.
Third round.
It was
okay.
An armbar in the third round, December of 2013. I can't remember
that
which
memory is pretty
UFC
damn impressive.
And it was Weidman Silva, too. That's why I remember it so well. You know, I think Misha's really improved since that fight.
So,
5 wins in a row.
So here's, I'm going to try to counter every single one of those points.
Go for
in
it.
Order. So number one, you said her chin might be a little messed up. Do you ever remember Miesha Tate hitting Rousey's chin? Go ahead and think about it.
I think she might have gotten her.
Maybe once.
Yeah.
I mean, like, not enough for me to be like, oh, this is going to be a boxing match, or oh, she's going to be able to hit her. Number two, yeah, I get the movie angle. But, I mean, she was doing movies when she was winning, too. I mean, she beat Betch Correa right after the Expendables. That's a decent piece. And I will agree with you that Tate has gotten better. That's the only one I won't counter. I will agree with you that Tate got better, but I just don't think that her strengths play well into fighting somebody like Ronda Rousey.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I was just trying to be a devil's advocate.
My
money's on Ronda, but I'm just saying, you said minus 1,200. It's not minus 1,200.
No, definitely not. I wish when I got to see those odds and I got some money in on Tate at that point, because, like, you know, not that I think Tate's going to win, but, if she was negative 1,200, she was probably plus 800 or plus 900 on the other side of it.
And
that's great money right there.
You're completely right, and we'd have to go back and watch the fight. I'm just going to bring up the fight metric here. Tate was 20 of 45 to significant strikes to the head, 4 of 5 to the body in that last fight. But to your point,
and that was one of the longer ones with her, right?
Yes. That was the one that went into the third round.
So 3 rounds, and she landed 20 headshots.
Well, like, Ronda only landed 24.
Well, Ronda doesn't have to land.
That's right. She was 6 of 8 from takedowns.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah. So, like, and you could argue that, like, Tate could take her down, but she's got the transitions from there. That, you know, that's what makes Ronda Rousey Ronda Rousey, is that her transitions from everywhere set up her armbar. And I just think that, you know, she's got the worst style for Miesha Tate.
And can we also say that Ronda had, in retrospect, the worst style for Holly to just bull rush in to try to get that clinch? You know, Holly was just like, yeah, come on in.
Yeah. Holly doesn't have a bad style for Miesha Tate, though. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Tate's style is what got her that win. Her ability to wrestle, her ability to do jiu-jitsu and stuff like that. But I think, you know, she could sharpen up her footwork and sharpen up her sprawl, which, you know, I assumed on the pre-fight show that I said her sprawl would be good enough. You were right on that one.
Well, it really was good enough, to be honest with you. If, you know, and she did survive the ground and pound on the second round. Miesha was determined, and you know what? It's like we talked about earlier. She's a great all-around MMA fighter. You know, she's not great in one area. She's very good in a lot of areas.
In a lot of areas, yeah. And I think that's probably different about Holm in Rousey, too. Not that Holm is bad at jiu-jitsu, but to back to that point where we were talking about GSP saying he would rather be a 7 at this, 7 at this, 7 at this,
right,
than a 10, 5, and 5. You know, Holm is probably a 10 at boxing,
right,
kickboxing, and a 5 at jiu-jitsu.
Right.
Rousey's probably a 10 at jiu-jitsu
in a five at boxing.
Right.
And you're right. Yeah. Tate's probably the 7-7. So
it's interesting.
Back to my original question, who's the best bantamweight in the world, Dave Tremonti?
Cyborg, if she can make
the Cyborg would have to lose a leg.
Yeah. No, great point.
You could say Tonya Evinger, she's the Invicta champion.
No, I'm good. I'm with you. It's a rock, paper, scissor. And that's awesome. So this is the last thing I want to talk about. Are we good on our breakdown?
Yeah, we're good. Okay. I mean, I was hoping for an answer, but I didn't get one.
No, I'm not giving one. But that's a great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it exciting. So here's the last thing. We have been on this train since episode one. We have been trying to track this. So we're past UFC 196. We saw what happened. Conor lost to Nate Diaz. So now, what do you do with UFC 200 to make it the biggest show of all time? Because, and let me just set this up, Ronda Rousey is coming off a loss and has said that she can't make it in time for UFC 200 in July. Conor McGregor is coming off a loss. Certainly, it would have been better had he won. But, you know, that's not to say they can't just book him in a fight and he'll hype the shit out of it with his talking. GSP was in the building at UFC 196.
He was in the building. I'm glad you noticed that, too. Leading, I saw him, and I was like,
leading to a
how lot. Very interesting. You know what I also thought when I saw that, too, is I thought to myself, I said, if Conor beats Diaz,
he would call him out.
I'm not saying he would call him out, but you don't think the UFC could have, like, finagled something where GSP winds up in the cage?
Oh, and says, Conor,
I am not impressed with your performance.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. So, you know, you have GSP out there, maybe a super fight, GSP Silva, although I think they're looking to book Silva in the Curitiba Brazil fight.
Yeah,
which
Yeah,
so my thought's probably off 200.
My thought process is if you go through the people who are already booked for title fights that you absolutely can't turn around, you assume that UFC 200 is going to have two title fights in a big fight. Or, you know, it's 200. Why not three title fights?
They could. They've stayed away from that in the past, but for 200,
it could be the first one with three title
fights.
And
just point of comparison, like WrestleMania, the biggest, you know, pay-per-view of the year, former pay-per-view of the year for WWE, has been running 4 hours the past few years.
Yeah.
So there's no reason UFC couldn't do a five-fight main card with three 25-minute title fights.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just say, for argument's sake, that they either got to do two big fights and super fight or three title fights.
Okay.
So,
well, we now know
let's,
at 199.
Let's count it down, first of all.
Jones,
heavyweights.
Booked. 198 May.
205. Booked. 197.
April. Cormier versus Jones.
185. Booked. 199.
Weidman versus Rockhold.
Okay. So
and then, on that same card, they just announce Faber versus Dominic Cruz.
Dominic Cruz.
For the bantamweight title.
So, bantamweight's out. So that leaves you 170.
Lawler
Robbie
is
going to
be in the mix, yep.
You got 155, you got 145, okay? You can't use 125, already booked. Can't use 135, already booked, like you said.
And just for point of comparison, 125 is booked at April, Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson versus Henry Cejudo, and then you also have the 115-pound...
Women are booked the night before, right?
Yeah,
Jacek
versus Gedalia. So that's a great breakdown.
In the bantamweight, the women's bantamweight, we assume is off the table.
Is off the table. So you're
looking at... So if there is three title fights...
You're looking at Lawler versus probably GSP. It's not going to be Lawler versus Woodley. That's not UFC 200 worthy.
Poor Tyrone Woodley. No, but you could do... So Lawler against... Take your pick. Wonderboy.
Nate Diaz. No, it's not going to be Wonderboy, though, because Wonderboy's fighting mid-June.
Oh, God. Wonderboy! So Nate Diaz or GSP.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Okay.
It's got to be one of those two.
And then 145.
And then we got to assume Conor
versus
Aldo
or
Edgar. Frankie Edgar. Conor versus Frankie Edgar.
Versus Aldo, right?
And then RDA versus the winner of Nurmagomedov.
But Nurmagomedov and Ferguson are on April 16th. They're not going to be able to turn around. Nurmagomedov fights once every 4 years.
If it's Nurmagomedov, I guarantee it won't be at 200.
I was actually going to say that a little earlier, too, and that was that, for all we know, Habib doesn't even make it to that fight, and then Nate Diaz steps in on that fight and fights Tony Ferguson.
I would watch the hell out of Tony Ferguson. But if we wrap that up, there are only three title fights out there that are possible for that
145, 155, and Robbie Lawler. And I just don't think Tyron Woodley, no offense to him,
So my point is you either got to book two of those, like Conor versus whoever and RDA versus whoever, and then hope you can get somebody like GSP or Anderson Silva or somebody for a big super fight like that.
Right.
Big name super fight. And if not, you have to book all or you could book all three of them. Other than that, you just have to make fun fights. I mean, like, Donald Cerrone's not booked right now.
They'll load up the up the card.
Donald Cerrone Poirier would be a great
fight week
opener.
Last year. 189 was loaded.
Oh yeah,
that was an awesome card.
So I mean, I think they'll do something similar to that. And but just for as many people as has wanted, like nailed on the headliner, there's not a lot of options left at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So with that said, we got to check in with Chris Kaladis, the 125-pound UFC fighter.
Yeah, he's fighting on that 197 card with John Jones and the 125-pound title fight that night too. And for those of you who don't know Chris Kaladis, really, really, really interesting prospect. He had a great fight with Ray Borg until he got submitted in the third round. Really tough fight. And he's beaten tough fighters Chris Beal and headliner Paddy O'Houlihan. So, I mean, you know, really legit 125-er. And we got to talk to him about his upcoming fight with Sergio Pettis.
All right. So let's cut to that interview right now.
This is Daniel Gumby Vreeland here with my co-host David Tremonti and Top Turtle MMA. We are here with Chris Kaladis, who is fighting April 23rd at UFC 197 against Sergio Pettis. Chris, how have we been doing?
Good, man. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about the lead up to the fight. So, you know, we saw a little bit of your training. You've been doing a little bit of training at a couple of gyms. Why don't you tell us what exactly that's been?
Yeah, I'm currently right now at American Top Team. I've been down here for a couple months and just training away, hoping to get a fight lined up. So it's been good, man. You know, good to train here outside of a camp and just, you know, develop skills and, you know, just get used to the grind.
And yeah, that's certainly a place that's got a lot of those lighter weight fighters. So let's talk a little bit about the lighter weights, because, you know, 125 notoriously has been a division that the UFC seems to have not gotten a lot of publicity to. What do you think the reason is why 125-pounders seem to get the shaft on that one, so to speak?
I mean, it's a fairly new division, too, so I think that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, the fact that there's just not a lot of fighters, it's kind of, it's a stagnant division right now, really, because, you know, the guys aren't, there's not a whole lot of activity. And of course, you know, a lot of people blame, you know, Mighty Mouse for not being the most entertaining champion, even though he's probably pound for pound one of the best fighters in the world. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of a conundrum. And I think, you know, sooner or later the UFC will push it a little bit more. But, you know, they have the women's divisions too. And I think they've just got a lot on their plate. So eventually, I think, you know, when there's more fighters that are added to the roster too, it'll kind of make things a little more dynamic.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that division being a tiny bit short and, you know, being kind of stagnant at the top. What do you need to do in 2016 to make your name at the top of that division? How many times do you think you need to fight, and are you fighting enough to get there?
No, I mean, that's definitely, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, you know, to you know, when you're not in a camp, that's when you're developing skills and getting better. But by the time I fight in April, I think it's going to be like 8 months since I last fought, so that's a lot of spare time, you know, and, you know, it's hard to rack up 3 and 4 fights a year if, you know, they're just not available. So, you know, this year, if I can get 3 in, that would be great, you know. So I guess my goals for this year is to just fight, you know, this fight with Sergio, win, and just, you know, kind of get ranked this year. That's my goal, is to be 2016, is to be your ranked fighter, and then, you know, you just kind of piece it all together, right?
So, Chris, how do you go about getting, let's say, 3 fights? Like you mentioned, you know, it's been 8 months since your last one. Do you just kind of try to stay in constant touch with the UFC and say, hey, I'm ready? Do you and your management team see a certain fight card that you say, hey, we want to get on that fight card? How does that kind of work for you to get 3 fights in this calendar year?
Yeah, I mean, I personally pay attention to what is going on. I was kind of waiting in the wings for some Canadian shows. And the Canadian shows, I mean, they just released the one now that'll be in June in Ottawa. So, I mean, when I started noticing the cards have a lot of the Canadian fighters that normally would fight on a Canadian card and they were fighting all abroad, I kind of clued into the fact that the Canadian card probably wasn't going to be in the first half of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of look at the events and, you know, I'm constantly, you know, after a few months, you send an email and just kind of, you know, let them know, kind of keep a bug in their ear. I messaged him and was talking with Sean right after my last fight, hoping that I could have got another one in before the end of last year. But, you know, those guys have a lot of fighters on the rosters, and he takes care of a certain number of them. And, you know, sometimes it's just his hands are tied as far as what they can offer. You know, you got divisions like 155 and 170 that have a huge roster, and they've got to get those guys fights too, right? So it's kind of a weird spot to be in when you're trying to get everybody, you know, three fights a year.
Absolutely. And onto that Ottawa card. So that Ottawa card coming up later in the summer, you know, obviously being Canadian yourself, is that something that you're going to jockey for, win, lose, or draw against Sergio Pettis?
Yeah, I mean, not looking past what's happening in April, but I would love to be on the next Canadian card that's available. And, you know, if it's Ottawa, that would be great. So we'll just have to, you know, play the cards as they lie here for the next couple months, and then see what's available come then.
Let's move on to your fight a little bit. So Sergio Pettis, definitely a whole different ball game than some of your past opponents. You know, Houlihan, Borg, and Beal, all kind of known more as on the grappling side of things. Obviously, the Pettis brother coming from Duke Rufus gym, you know, his older brother's a great striker. He's a fairly good striker. You know, what did you have to do to get ready for him that's different than in the past?
I wouldn't say that there's anything really, you know, I mean, obviously there's certain things that I know that he's probably going to do more so than other guys that I fought, but, you know, it's just about developing more of my skills, you know, which is why I wanted to get down here and start training a little bit before I had, you know, a fight camp, just because the last time that I trained down here at American Top Team, you know, I only had like 6 or 7 weeks. You're thrown right into it, and you don't have a chance to really develop, you know, additional skills. You're just worried about getting in shape, and this is the game plan, and implementing it. So, you know, there's things that I'm working on and getting better at, and that's the way it should be. And, you know, as the next few weeks progress, we'll have some things that I'll probably isolate and specifically train more so. But I think at the end of the day, you can't really pay attention too much to the guy, you know, what the guy is going to do to you as much as what you want to do to that guy, right?
So, Chris, wrapping up here, before we let you go, we wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't ask. Just a couple of days ago on Saturday night, the MMA universe, the center of the MMA universe was Diaz versus McGregor. What were your thoughts on that fight, and were you Team Diaz or Team McGregor going into it?
You know, it's very hard to count Conor McGregor out, obviously. Yeah. But I was definitely, I was pulling for the underdog. I was pulling for Diaz because I just thought, you know, the bigger size and his ability to take punishment. You know, he rolls, him and his brother both roll really good with taking power shots, and I thought if he could weather that storm, that it would be a completely different fight. And I think that's really what happened, is he was really good at taking those shots and then still standing there and still being in front of him. And that kind of blew McGregor's mind, I think, and made him mentally break, I think.
Yeah, we actually just said something very similar in the open of our show, which was there almost was like a, oh my God moment out of Conor, where he saw that the left wasn't landing, or even if it did, it wasn't that same, you know, impact that he had at the featherweight division. And that's when you saw him drop his hands and kind of look a little exasperated, like, what do I have to do to this guy?
Yeah, it didn't show very good maturity as far as I'm concerned as a fighter, because, you know, in a fight, you know, what do you're always going to count on that one shot putting somebody out. You can't, you know what I mean? You got to be ready for plan B and C, right?
All right, well, Chris, we cannot thank you enough for the time. We wish you all the luck in the world in your next fight, and we will be watching and rooting for you.
Perfect. I appreciate it, guys. Thanks.
All right, Gumby, there you have it. Chris Kalaitis, nice guy.
Yeah, great guy. Talking a little bit about the tough part about finding fights, especially at 125 in a, you know, a division that hasn't gotten a lot of publicity. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, he was very open and honest about that. And, you know, we'll look forward to his fight against Sergio Pettis.
I certainly will. Definitely.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for us. You can catch us at Gmail. TopTurtleMMA@gmail.com is the email. @TopTurtleMMA is the Twitter. @GumbyVreeland is Gumby's personal Twitter account. And MMA-manifesto.com is our parent website. Thank you for joining us once again. We will be back next week with a special episode 10. I don't really know what's special about it other than the fact that it's our 10th episode, but we are looking forward to it.
We're looking forward to it. And what might be special about it is you might get music on this
one. Sorry again about the explosions.
Yeah, so this is kind of a raw feed for a podcast, but we had to get it out, and we are glad we did. So thank you for joining us. When you get to the top turtle position in MMA, you should always be looking to finish. We are top turtle. We are finished.